Hey kids, I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast you're going to love. On behalf of myself, Morgan Rector, of one of the most horrific true crime podcasts, Human Monsters, I'd like to ask you this question. Do you like to travel? Do you like picturesque locations and getting away from it all? Fun fact, there is a morgue on every cruise ship. After all, people die everywhere. Why wouldn't they die on a cruise ship in the Bahamas? Well, this new podcast has all that and murder. It's called Slaycation, and it's a darkly humorous look at murders and mysterious deaths that took place on vacation. Hosted by true crime fanatic, her comedy writer husband, and his TV producing partner, Slaycation brings a unique perspective to chilling, thrilling, and what-the-fuck stories of vacations gone horribly wrong. From the twisted tale of Harold and Tony Henthorne, whose romantic anniversary in the Rocky Mountains ended with one of them falling off a cliff, to Angelica and Vincent, two recently engaged lovebirds whose Hudson Valley kayaking adventure ended underwater. Each episode of Slaycation will have you asking, accident or murder? But it's not just the stories that'll intrigue you. It's the discussion between a longtime married couple and business partners who happen to be Emmy-nominated TV producers. Each episode of Slaycation also includes humor, takeaway, and travel tips that will keep your next vacation from being your last. If you're ready to pack your body bags, Slaycation is available on all major podcast platforms. Search for Slaycation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Yo tengo casi 33 años de ser forense. Nunca había visto una escena así.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador. Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador. The story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor Ministro. ¿Dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero? ¿Dónde están mis hijos?
Listen to Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Human Monsters, and welcome to another Double Trouble episode of the Human Monsters podcast. This week's episode will feature two criminals, and then two more, who can honestly only be described as trouble. Their motives are so bizarre, and their crimes so senseless, that in the end, they got what they deserved. We are, as always, grateful for the incredible support you show every week for the show. Thank you so much, especially to our Plus and Patreon members who help us to keep the home fires burning. Now let's get on with the show. Part 1. The Case Against Raoul Mote. In July 2010, the largest manhunt in British history was launched to find the elusive Raoul Mote. He had already killed, and his open hatred for police convinced authorities that he will for sure kill again. Raoul had nothing left to lose. The case regarding Raoul Mote is one that is well known, and during the time the events take place, many youngsters who were thinking about becoming police officers took a double take when it came to crime fighting as a career. Raoul Mote was born in Newcastle, which is in the northern part of England, on the 17th of June, 1968. He grew up with his brother, Angus, who described Raoul as an outgoing and generous soul with a great sense of humor. Others would, however, say that he was far from an angel. Raoul committed acts of animal cruelty and arson as a child. The two brothers were mostly raised by their maternal grandmother under less than desirable circumstances. They had what they needed, and their grandmother provided them to her best ability with food, clothing, and a warm bed. Their grandmother was a stabilizing factor in their lives, because Raoul would never really know his father. His father was a man named Peter Blake. Peter would claim that he never knew Raoul's mother, Josephine Healy. When she was pregnant, she plainly refused to disclose any information about him to anyone once she discovered she was with child. His mother had mental illness issues and once even burnt all Raoul's toys and ended up rejecting him, which is the reason he ended up with his grandmother. His mother would continue to live with another man only a few doors down from his grandmother. Raoul must have experienced abandonment issues, which only aggravated his bad behavior later in life. Raoul and Angus were close as children, but as they grew older, Raoul became obsessed with bodybuilding. Within the bodybuilding community, he formed new friends and alliances, and he would eventually become a bouncer. Angus, on the other hand, went to university to follow a more academic career. Not all bouncers are out there looking for fights. Some do their jobs effectively and de-escalate situations. But for Raoul, it was an opportunity to vent his frustrations. Raoul did not stay long as a bouncer and instead started a tree trimming business, which he called Mr. Trim. He was struggling with mental illness at this point and was self-aware enough to reach out to social services for help, which shows a sense of vulnerability as well. It does not appear that he received the help he needed to deal with his childhood abandonment issues, and those who knew him became seriously concerned about his mental health. He became paranoid, insecure, and obsessive, and incredibly sensitive. His distrust in all around him grew, and he began believing he was alone in the world. Friends said he suffered frequent bouts of depression, and all he wanted to be was a family man. When he finally did have children, he apparently was a good father, but there was always that undercurrent of paranoia, especially towards the police, who he thought were out to persecute him. This could be attributed to the fact that he was working as a doorman and had frequent interactions with cops, and he was also using steroids at this point. He also had been in two documented instances of road rage, and his girlfriend was beaten on a regular basis. He was jealous and controlling, and was once arrested for beating up his child, for which he spent 18 weeks in prison. In total, he had been arrested 12 times in the previous decade, and of those times, he received 7 charges, and he had only been convicted once. At 6'3" and weighing 280 pounds, he was a formidable adversary. On the 1st of July 2010, at the age of 37, the wheels finally came off the Raoul Mote Ferris wheel of madness. At this point, he had 3 children, and this was the day he was released from Durham Prison. Northumbria police had already been warned that he intended to cause serious bodily harm to his partner. It was not actually his current partner, but a girlfriend called Samantha Stobart, who was 22 years old. It was suspected that just before he was released, Samantha had told him something that had infuriated him, and while in prison, this comment stewed into a plan of revenge in his mind. Samantha and Raoul had been in a 6-year relationship before he was incarcerated, and with his personality and the huge age difference, it's not difficult to imagine that she had been dominated and abused. The couple had a daughter together before he went to prison, but once he was behind bars, Samantha decided to end the relationship. Like all abusers, Raoul was furious because he believed he was in control and should call all the shots, including when the relationship ends. Unfortunately for him, Samantha had already begun seeing a 29-year-old karate instructor named Chris Brown. He had only recently relocated to Newcastle, and it was while canvassing for clients that he met Samantha. Samantha must have felt that she finally had a strong and kind man to protect her, and that from prison, Raoul could not hurt her. She had no idea that one of his 24-year-old friends and a former business partner by the name of Carl Ness had been enlisted to spy on her and to report back to him. Raoul undoubtedly knew by the time he left the prison gates that, regardless of the fact that they were no longer together, Samantha had a new man in her life. His possessive nature and the overpowering feeling that he had lost control of the situation made locating them after release his first priority. He not only had a grudge against the couple, but also against the Northbridge police, who he believed were keeping him away from his children unnecessarily. It's a sickening trait of violent offenders to not give a shit about their children until they can be used as capital. Samantha had been so in fear of her life when Raoul came out of prison that she told him she was seeing a police officer. The motivation for the lie came from a place of utter fear, but this information just put fuel on the fire of hatred for anyone in a police uniform. Raoul did not take the white lie very well. In a Facebook post just after he was released, he wrote, "Just got out of jail, lost everything. My business, my property, and to top it all off, my lass of 6 years has gone off with the copper who sent me down." Samantha's lie had suddenly grown a tail. But Mote was not just threatening them. He was openly declaring war against all police officers. He had begun to build a persona of self-righteous rage. On Friday, the 2nd of July, 2010, Chris and Samantha were visiting their neighbors late at night. As Samantha and Chris were enjoying their new relationship with friends, Raoul was planning his attack on the young lovers. In the early hours of Saturday, the 3rd of July, Carl Ness, who had continued to spy on the couple, drove Raoul in a stolen white transit van to Samantha's home. As Carl waited in the vehicle, Raoul began looking for the couple. He was armed with a sawed-off shotgun with homemade cartridges, which Carl had helped him to get. He stayed outside the property for half an hour and could hear the couple socializing with their friends inside. He waited till 2:40 a.m. until the couple emerged and approached them from behind. Samantha saw him approach and tried to warn Chris, but the two shotgun blasts ensured Chris never stood a chance. As Chris fell dead on the ground, Samantha ran back into her neighbor's home to hide, because she knew he was coming for her next. Raul was, however, not done with Chris, and shot another cartridge into the back of his head. Raul then shot two more shots through the window, of which one hit Samantha's arm and in her stomach. Raul claimed he never wanted to kill her because he just did not want other men to see her body again, especially in a swimsuit. Carl, who had heard the gunshots, drove away, leaving his buddy behind. Raul flagged down a taxi, knowing the police were on their way. Both Carl and Raul went to the same guy to get them out of this fix, 23-year-old mechanic Kareem Akin, to procure a getaway vehicle. A manhunt was immediately launched for Raul. 160 officers were deployed, making it the biggest manhunt in the history of Britain. 15 other regional police officers. The total amount this exercise would cost the taxpayers was £1.1 million. Residents were warned not to approach him because he was armed and dangerous. During a search of his home, police found a noose in his loft and a suicide note. The note to Samantha sounded more like emotional blackmail than a declaration of love. By Sunday, the 4th of July, 12:40 p.m., the three fugitives were traveling in a black Lexus on the A1. By now, Raul felt he had nothing left to lose, and his first victim, 42-year-old father of two, David Rathbone, was sitting in his patrol vehicle when Raul spotted him. He was an experienced officer, but Raul jumped out of the Lexus and shot the officer twice in the face at point-blank range. Moat thought he had killed him, and the officer played dead until his shooter left. Once the coast was clear, he made his way to his radio and called for help. It would take many operations to remove over 200 shotgun pellets from his face. He was permanently blinded from the attack. Twelve minutes before he saw his next victim, he called 999. He took responsibility for shooting Chris because he thought he was a police officer and that he intended to hunt down any cops he could find, and identified himself as the Barkley gunman, and that he was going to wage war on the police. He told them he was not on the run. As a matter of fact, he was coming for them. The call that is available online is mostly Raul ranting, claiming he is not at fault and that he was going to turn himself in, but decided against it. He claimed that he tried to go straight for the last 6 years, but that police would not leave him alone. He also said he had two hostages and was going to kill more cops.
Hello there, this is the gunman from Berkeley last night. My name is Raul Moat. What I'm phoning about is to tell you exactly why I've done what I've done, right? Now, my girlfriend has been having an affair behind my back with one of your officers, this gentleman that I shot last night, the Crawley instructor, right? He's been on to me, right, for years. He's hassled us, harassed us, he has just won't leave us alone. I went straight 6 years ago when I met her, and I've tried my best to have a normal life, and you just won't let up. Right? You won't leave us enough for 5 minutes. I can't drive down the street without the blue flashing lights. You know? You have stitched this up for years. You've been caught stitching this up. So the fact of the matter is, right, that she's having an affair with one of your officers. Well, he's a police officer, I wouldn't have shot him.
Okay.
As that, right? But the thing is, you know, it's been going on. It's been going on for a while. I went to jail, right?
Okay.
I got stitched up by you for hitting your kid, which I didn't do, right?
Right.
I went to jail for something I didn't do. Now, I could have took a community order, right?
Yeah.
But what happened is me and Sam had a discussion with the barrister. I went to jail. Within 3 to 4 weeks, the barrister promised us and let us down. She said she would have us on a retrial, get the not guilty, so me and my son would live together.
Uh-huh.
Now, I went to jail, right?
Hang on a minute, you're losing me there, yeah.
Right? Well, I went to jail longer than I should have done for something I didn't do, right? Which justify that in your own head.
Yes.
Right? And meanwhile, while I'm doing that for my missus, she's having an affair with one of your officers, right? And then when I come out, right, she's winding us up saying that he's going to stitch us up using him,
yes.
Right? And, you know, that he's this, he's that, he's going to, because he's a multiple backbend, he's going to kick
right.
The ass all over the place.
Okay, you know okay. Mm-hmm.
Right? And I've had nothing but grief. I've had a good relationship with her for 6 years, which is why we've stayed together. I've gone straight, I've got a total legitimate life with her, I've opened a business,
right.
And
right.
I've had the pen shafted. And you police have took too much off me over the years. You've
okay.
Won't take a load. Now you think you can take your missus. Now, I didn't mean to shoot her like that, right?
Okay.
Right? They deserved it, right? But she, right, you can see from the ballistics I've been altering those cartridges, right?
Mm-hmm.
That one was only half the powder. It was only meant to get a compensation, because obviously I'm not going to be around in a few days, right? It was meant to just give her a little injury so she can get loads of compensation.
Okay.
For your separate event. Now that I found out she's critical, I'm not happy about it. I didn't mean that. You know what I mean? I'm quite surprised she is critical, you know? But I didn't mean that. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not coming in alive. You have hassled me for so many years. Hey, come anywhere near me and I'll kill you. I've got 2 hostages at the minute, right? Come anywhere near me and I'll kill them as well. I'm coming to get you. I'm not on the run. I am coming to get you. You have made me unwell. You have made me do this because you just won't leave me out of... You know, you just won't leave us alone.
Can you confirm you've got 2 hostages?
I've confirmed I've got 2 hostages, yes.
Right. And where are you?
I'm not going to tell you where I am.
Okay, I'm
coming
enough, yeah.
To get those normally, right?
Yeah. Can I just confirm who you are? Can you give me your date of birth, please?
Yes, it's the 17th of June, 1973.
Right, okay then. Thank you very much.
Right, I am very sorry for what's happened, son. That's not what I meant.
Right.
You know? But I'll tell you something else. This other idiot in the paper that's saying I'm pointing the gun. You know, he's had to, like, you know, he starts having to control him and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
He was accused, right? I heard rumours in jail that he was sleeping with my son.
Now,
I saw the Tom's dad yesterday, and he said he heard the same rumours as well, but he didn't believe it was true, but he was definitely trying to get into it. So listen to me, but I'll tell you, he was the first one to run and hide upstairs, leaving his wife and leaving everybody else. You know what I mean? He didn't stand there and let a gun point at me, because had I pointed at him, I would have shot him, because I do believe he was getting into her. There's been a lot of nonsense going on behind my back while I've been in jail. She's changed. She's not off, changed. And every time I spoke to her and tried to be reasonable, she wouldn't let us anywhere near the bend.
Right.
To go to the house, she wouldn't discuss anything, and she was threatening us for one of your officers.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I've had enough. I've had enough. Jail made us unwell. I've came up with different kids. You know what I mean? I've lost everything through you. Right? Just won't leave us alone, right? So, at the end of the day, you've killed me. You killed me and him before that trigger was ever pulled.
Right.
You know what I mean?
We are trying to help you.
You wanted me to do myself in, and I was going to do it until I found out about him properly and what was going on. And as soon as I found out his office, I thought, nah, you've had too much from me. You'll get your chance to kill us, right? You'll get your chance to kill us.
Right.
Okay?
We don't want to do that.
You don't want to kill yourself, but I'm going to give you a chance, because I am hunting for officers now.
After shooting the officer, Moat called 999 again. He asked the operator, "Are you taking me serious now? I am destroying lives the way you destroyed mine." The cops were painfully aware he had not only 2 hostages with him, but an unwavering vendetta against the police. No one knew the so-called hostages were actually accomplices, but used as leverage. A press release was issued, warning the public about the dangerous man on the run, and soon the abandoned Lexus was discovered at the side of the road. While on the run, Moat met up with a friend of his named Andy McAllister, and he gave him a 49-page document, which he said was his side of the story. In the manifesto, he said the public did not need to fear him. A 10,000-pound reward was offered, and a 2-mile area was cordoned off. On the 5th of July, Samantha even made a plea to Moat from her hospital bed to stop the madness. On the same day, he robbed a chip shop near Blight. He stole food and witnesses could see his so-called hostages were accomplices. Kareem and Carl helped Moat to set up camp, and to this day, their loyalty towards him remains a mystery. Police, however, knew he was familiar with Sleeping Rough, and they discovered abandoned campsites in the area. Moat had also been sleeping in gardens and sneaking into spare rooms of homes that looked unoccupied at the time. The police used every available resource from dogs to helicopters, but Moat seemed to stay one step ahead. They suspected that they would catch him near Rothbury, and many arrests were made of people who in any way assisted Moat. Carl and Kareem were quickly caught, but they pled their innocence. Cops called bullshit because the evidence was very clear that the two accomplices were not hostages. Apart from them leaving notes to their loved ones explaining they were helping their friend who was on the run, they were walking down a country lane, wearing bright clothing and unfamiliar to the locals. On the morning of the 6th of July, the sleepy and rural little village of Rothbury was inundated with police patrolling the streets, parks, and fields. On Wednesday, the 7th of July, Moat was still on the run, managing to avoid the cops, but he was running out of time. At one of the campsites, he had left a dictaphone, complaining about the portrayal of the media of him. And thus, he would kill a member of the public as revenge. A gag order was immediately placed on all press and media. On the 8th of July, villagers were terrified, even avoiding drain covers. Some reported they had seen him move at night, and there were reports that he had stolen vegetables from gardens. On the 9th of July, a local resident spotted a man near the riverbank that she believed was Raoul Moat. As soon as Moat saw the approaching police vehicles, he went down on his knees and put the gun to his head. That would be the beginning of a six-hour standoff. Police wanted to apprehend him alive, and police negotiators tried to convince him the best would be to surrender. In the early hours of Saturday morning, with very little light to spare, a special taper was used, but it did not work. At 1:15 a.m., a shot rang out as Raoul Moat finally decided to take his own life. Carl Ness and Kareem A. Wan were convicted of conspiracy to murder, attempted murder, and armed murder. March 2011, Carl was sentenced to 20 years in prison, and Kareem was sentenced to 40 years in prison. In 2012, police constable Rothman took his own life because he could not cope with his blindness. By proxy, he became another victim of a man who thought the world owed him everything and that he was the victim in it all. Part 2. The case against Nico Jenkins. One look at Nico Jenkins' face, and you just know this is a man not to be messed with. Still, his story is tragic, full of violence, and a massive failure by the system. But we are not here to judge or condemn criminals. Well, okay, I do judge sometimes. We tell the stories and let you decide how you feel about the perpetrator. Please let us know on our socials what your thoughts are about this enigma of a man. The man who has had more than 50 million views on YouTube was born in Colorado, but grew up in Omaha, Nebraska on the 16th of September, 1986. He had five sisters and the kind of childhood that is prone to produce dysfunction. His household was a dome of violence, with not just him being physically abused, but having to watch violent abuse around him. All family members, including his parents, who were Laura McGee and David Jenkins, resolved issues with fists, kicks, and other forms of physical retribution. Often Nico would have to intervene as his parents were in a full-on physical fight. He remembered cleaning up blood from the floor at the age of 4, and this is a memory that remained with him for the rest of his life. The statistics regarding his entire lineage are jaw-dropping. Nico's great-grandfather was Levi Levering, who was a well-respected leader of the Cherokee tribe, had 38 of his direct descendants as convicted criminals. In total, they had committed 633 separate crimes since 1969. When Nico was 7 years old, he took a loaded shotgun to school. Thankfully, no one was hurt, but the authorities believed that placing him in foster care would be the best option for him. His family was already well known for their criminal activities, but it was the first time Nico's name would come up in the criminal index. While in foster care, he spoke for the first time about thoughts of hurting himself and to hurt others. Indeed, he also wanted to teach his classmates a lesson that had nothing to do with geography or social studies. He wanted to teach them with his gun. You're never too young to be an asshole. He was constantly wetting his bed, which was attributed to anxiety at home, and he would eventually be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is the first of many diagnoses he would be given. For most of his childhood, he bounced around from foster home to foster home, but most of the time, he would be kicked out of these places of refuge because of his violent behavior. He joined his first gang at the age of 11, and from this point on, he was always in possession of a weapon. He was arrested numerous times for arson, weapons charges, and robbery, which meant he was in and out of juvenile detention centers all the time. He had a habit of running away and being able to avoid being caught for months on end, but he was always brought back to complete his sentences. They should have left him where he was. At the age of 17, Nico committed 2 armed carjackings, for which he was sentenced to 14 to 15 years in prison. At first, he was sent to a juvenile detention center until he was 19 years old, after which he was sent to an adult prison. He was not behaving himself while in prison. He took part in riots and took up tattooing as an extra income. His entire face would eventually be full of tattoos and marks left from self-mutilation. When his grandmother died, he was allowed to go to her funeral, but even then, Nico tried to escape by attacking a guard and even biting the officer in an attempt to get away. His antics gained him another 5 years to his sentence, but numerous reports have been written about the negative effects of being in solitary confinement for long periods of time, and all concluded that more than a week or two will undoubtedly do damage to the psyche of the prisoner. And Nico was already a man with a mind in serious need of psychiatric help. He was actually in solitary confinement for a solid 2-year block before he was released. He would be released after only 10 years of his sentence. Of his 10 years in prison, he was in solitary confinement for 60% of the time. 5 months before his release, he was assessed by psychiatrists and psychologists. He was clearly struggling with his mental health and self-harming and would mutilate his face. He had suicidal thoughts and had reported to staff that he wanted to eat the hearts of men, women, and children when he was released. Never a good sign. Nico was also known to drink his own urine and drink and snort his own semen on a daily basis. I know prison grub isn't the greatest, but come on. He claimed he did this to heighten his vitality and to help him control his rage. He also claimed to worship the Egyptian god Apophis, which is represented by a snake-like figure. During his incarceration, Nico even tried to shape his penis with a blade in the shape of a snake. His mutilation and tattoos on his face continued to multiply, and he even tried to cut his tongue into the shape of that of a snake. In other words, forked. He told medical staff that he continued to have uncontrollable and racing thoughts. He had obsessive and racing thoughts and continued to hear voices. Nico himself asked not to be released and even asked for help, but his pleas were ignored. He even told authorities that if they released him, he was going to kill again. Despite knowing all these alarming facts, the authorities decided to release Nico in July of 2013, straight from solitary confinement. What boggles the mind is that he was released without any probation, parole, or monitoring of any kind. Nico was a free man to live his life as he pleased in society. His family held a huge welcome home party for him on the 30th of July 2013 in a hotel. His uncle Warren even gave him a shotgun as a welcome home present. Gee, how apropos. At the party, Nico proclaimed that he wanted to move to Florida, get some cash together through robberies, and move to Cuba, which is such a random plan that it could only make sense to the insane. The part about him ending up in Florida makes sense, though. On the 10th of August 2013, his sister Erica Jenkins and his cousin Christine Borden hatched a plan to make some quick money. The plan was for the two women to target two men with the promise of sex and then to rob them. Erica and Christine went to a local bar where they met Juan Urabequenea and Jorge Cajigaruz. The two women convinced them two men to drive to a private location, and as they stopped, Nico jumped out and shot both men in the head with the 12-gauge shotgun he had just received as a present. Couldn't they have given him an air fryer instead? Both men died instantly, and when police discovered their bodies, their pockets were turned out. It appears that Nico never intended to just rob them. He wanted to kill both men. There was no link to Nico, so he carried on with his life as normal. 8 days later, he stumbled upon Curtis Bradford, who he had spent time in prison with. There's actually a photograph of the two of them throwing some kind of gang sign, which ironically resembled the fangs of a snake. At the party, Nico expresses to Curtis that he wanted to commit some robberies, and Curtis, without hesitation, said, yes, he's all in. Curtis, Erica, and Nico got into the car, and someone hands Curtis a gun. Little did Curtis know that the gun was not loaded. As they got to their destination, Erica suddenly turns her gun on Curtis and shoots him from behind, in the head. Apparently, Erica was very proud of herself, because this was her first kill. But Nico was furious because he wanted to be the one to kill Curtis. Out of anger, he grabs his gun and shoots Curtis in the back of the head as well. A passerby would later find Curtis's body on the side of the road and report it to the police. 2 days after the murder of Curtis, Little Wayne came to town, and Nico thought this would be an amazing way to rob people at the concert. He felt, however, that his car was not smart enough to fit into the scene, which gave him the grand idea of hijacking another better vehicle to be able to blend into the crowd. Nico, Christine, Erica, and his uncle Warren decided to stake out McDonald's for a possible better car to steal. Unfortunately for Andrea Kruger, her SUV caught their eye, and they began to follow her. Once she stopped at a junction, Nico jumped out of the car and dragged Andrea out of her SUV. He shot her 4 times. Nico and Warren jumped into Andrea's car as Christine and Erica followed in their car. The mother of 3, who was just on her way from work, lost her life in the attack. The gang never committed any robberies, and Warren ended up burning the car they had just hijacked. Another 10 days would go by, but on the 30th of August, Nico was arrested for a fight he had with his girlfriend because he threatened to kill her. He had also promised to send demonic forces to his girlfriend's parents' house. Well, who hasn't wished demonic forces upon their in-laws? At this point, police were still unaware that he had been the driving force behind the murders of 4 people. While Nico was in jail for the threats, police started to suspect that the unhinged man with a face full of graffiti could be involved in the crimes that had been committed around Newcastle. Security footage showed that Nico's mom had been the one to purchase the exact same ammunition used in all 4 murders. The Jenkins family were already notorious, and with Nico in custody, police decided to put him in an interrogation room and ask him a couple of questions. On the 3rd of September, the interview with Nico begins, and it would last an entire 8 hours. The footage is readily available online, and Nico is the one doing most of the talking. He claims that he was not involved and that he only was there to give the intelligence. He also claims that all the killings were part of a ritual sacrifice. He also blamed the murders on his sister and his cousin. Then he claims that he did indeed commit the murders in the name of Apophis. But once again, he changed his story and claims that he committed the murders as revenge on the correctional services who should never have let him out. He repeatedly told the interviewers, "I told you, I should never have been let out. I am going to kill someone."
There you go.
I'm going to call you. I should be alone. I need to speak to someone.
Okay.
Because that's what makes my mind frame goes back. I'm schizophrenic, bipolar, sir. I don't take medication. So right now, that's why I'm going to stay. That's why I told them they need to hurry up when I'm in this mind frame.
Okay.
So that when I speak to you, this is clear.
I am.
But another thing, what I'm about to do, you, the sheriff office, and you guys need to be honest with me.
Okay.
Because if we're going to make this work and get this closure for this family, you're going to have to tell me what you have and what you don't have. That way I know if I have to go get it for you, because these are my cousins.
Okay.
These are my 2 family members, the ones that were in the house that day.
Okay.
They're brothers. But the one of them, you think I'm a mental case. He's a severe mental case. He has documented being in Lincoln Regional Center, Psychiatric Hospital. See what I'm saying? So
all right,
he goes into it. Like, even when y'all arrested me, I don't know if you were on the team, but he was acting up when they were pulling us out the house.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So I just don't want this to, you know, that's why I didn't want to talk down at the jail, because there's family members on my dad's side, because this is on my father's side.
Okay. I get him on the stick, all right? I'm going to make you a fresh pot, too. That's not the best, but it's what we got right now. But I'll make you a fresh pot. Here it is. All right? You good?
I need to speak to her superiors about this, the ones that I know that can...
He's my boss.
This is a man.
The ones that I know that can make the...
Nico.
John Pankinen.
First of all, this is going to be a long night, but you're going to get everything that you need to give her family closure. But I want you to understand something, and I'm going to say this very clearly. I was not there. Only thing I was hearsay, not hearsay, but to say, like, okay, my religion of Catoni Asunpel, that's the underworld. He was like on the mummy, the black book. So this was them, my little cousins, the one that were in the house with me, that when I got to serve the search warrant.
Right.
This was their ritual of sacrifice. And I'm going to give you from A to Z. This is not no goose chase. This is the real deal right here, which people signed up for.
Okay. Before we get any further, though, I need to read you this rights advisory form, okay?
I never knew the who, the what, the when, the where. Only thing I gave was the intelligence.
Okay, describe this to me. What this 9mm, describe it to me.
Describe the weapon?
Yes.
It's a high point. It's a high point. I believe it's a high point rifle. But it shoots 9mm slugs. And if you was to see this weapon, you would not believe that it was the murder weapon. Like I said, weeks prior to this, when I first got out, I gave intelligence. Like I said, I didn't know who was coming, what was coming, who was it going to be used on. All I did was give the intelligence.
What kind of intelligence?
Intelligence of when would be the best window of opportunity. What roles to take in. If you're going to do something way out west, they have cameras on the lights. As you know, when you take Fort from Military Ave, it takes you all the way out with no cameras, pitch black at nighttime. You realize that one, right? So if you're coming from that crime scene, you can hit it straight out to Fort, and take Fort all the way back to Military Ave, all the way to the Walmart. That's off right off the interstate. Ain't that Walmart right off the interstate? Off of Military Ave?
Yeah.
So my point is, things like that, the intelligence of what paths to take. You know what I mean? To avoid the cameras. Things of that nature. The bar closed at this time, bartenders, and they're walked out to their cars, but after that, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Because the specific point was to get her to an isolated place. You see what I'm saying? To where, and obviously, when you're out there, only thing that's, like, especially off of Maple, once you leave off of Maple, everything is black. Everything's black out there. So, it was a perfect opportunity. And that's why y'all don't even understand, man. I don't understand how hard this is for me right now, because I'm portraying my family. Do you understand it? This is not just me. I understand one family's getting closer, you know, but I'm literally betraying my family and my bloodline.
You all right?
You all right, man?
That's what I don't understand, man. Is that all I was in the restaurant person, man. All I wanted was help from the people, man.
Yeah, you can go over. Yeah. You'd like to find somebody.
Or
somebody might have
something. You need more copy or not? Yes, please.
Okay.
But I'm telling you right now, what I just given them, I will testify to that. This is the first time that I've ever aided an assistant law enforcement in my life. So any jury, any judge, any prosecutor will be, once I sit on that stand and testify to this, it's golden. Any jury is not going to look at me and say, oh, he's told before. And he done. With my history and my reputation, and this first time testimony of ever aided an assistant law enforcement, and everything that I'm saying is accurate.
Okay. This is... You gotta come with me.
I understand.
Because here, listen to me.
But listen.
No, I've listened to you for a long time. It's time for you to listen to me. Because like what you said, if you don't tell me what the heck happened out there, people are going to think the absolute worst. People are going to think the absolute worst. If this is a robbery went bad, if this someone panicked, if this did something really stupid, now's the time. Because otherwise, you're right. They're going to look at Nico Jenkins as a flat, bloody killer. That's what's going to happen. Do you not realize I got Nico Jenkins? Do you not realize that? I got Nico Jenkins. I got you.
What do you mean you got me?
I got your DNA at the murder scene. I got your DNA in the car.
Sir.
I got the weapon. I got Nico Jenkins. I don't need to make I don't care about it. I just want other people that are involved in it. What the hell happened out there? And why? Alright, you know, I know who. I know what. I know when. I know where. And then when I talked to you earlier, you were saying stuff about a carjacking.
That woman's husband and children. That woman's husband is grieving right now. This is not just some psycho killer that just wanted to go trophy. I'm documented psychiatrically disordered. Mm-hmm. I've documented chemical imbalance. This is a fact.
Yeah.
So my point is...
We're well aware of that.
My point is this, though. This family didn't deserve this.
Right.
This could have been prevented had it not been for the Nebraska Department of Corrections doing what they knew what they were supposed to have did. And they never gave me an opportunity. They never gave me an opportunity for treatment because I wouldn't take the medicine.
He not only confessed eventually to the police for the murders, but he also wrote to an Omaha newspaper in November taking responsibility for the killings. While in jail, Nico files a lawsuit for $27.5 million against the state of Nebraska, claiming that all the carnage could have been prevented if they never let him out. He once again said he was not fit to stand trial due to his mental illness, and a judge orders an assessment for him. During one of many assessments, there would be one person who believed that Nico was absolutely mentally ill and not fit to stand trial, and that was Dry Olivetti. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. This was, however, all ignored, and the prosecution claimed that Nico was making all of this up. Nebraska was one of the few states that still had the death penalty, and to this day, Dry Olivetti, who is in his 80s now, holds to his belief that Nico should be in a mental institution for life. The claim was that all he had was an antisocial personality disorder, which is probably true. The difference is mental illness is a disease, while a personality disorder is not. His troubled childhood, littered with alcohol and drug abuse by pretty much everyone in his clan, also played no role in the verdict. Nico, when asked why he shot Andrea so many times, said that he did her a favor. His first shot only took one half of her head off, so he decided to take the other half off with a shotgun blast as well. Only he would be able to make sense of that logic. Nico was deemed fit to stand trial, and as the trial begins, he fires his entire defense team and decides to represent himself. Throughout the trial, he never denies committing the murders, but he does claim he is not responsible for them. He said that it was the god Apophis that made him kill as a sacrifice, and out of the blue during the trial, Nico started to talk in a strange language. The closest I can explain it is when people in charismatic churches claim to speak in tongues. On the 16th of April, 2014, Nico was found guilty of all four murders. The question remained whether he was competent enough to be sentenced to death. His sentencing kept on being delayed, and his name became a regular feature in local papers as the debate on whether he is mentally ill continued. As he awaited his sentence, Nico decided to carve the numbers 666 into his forehead. Unfortunately for him, he did it in a mirror, and the numbers came out backwards. This is also when he sliced his tongue to make it look like that of a serpent, and which required 9 stitches. However, he got hold of a razor during this time and tried to carve his penis into the form of a snake. He also got hold of a guard's keys and managed to swallow all 7 of them. This mutilation required 27 stitches. He continued to mutilate his face, and in May of 2017, he was finally sentenced to 450 years behind bars for the murders and other crimes he committed, as well as 4 death penalties. The rest of the family was also charged for their part in the crimes. Nico's mom got 10 years in prison for aiding and abetting her son. Erica was given a life term for the murder of Curtis Bradford and taking part in some of the robberies. Christine was given a 20-year sentence for her part in the robberies. Her sentence was substitutionally lighter because she informed on her family members. Erica and Christine actually at one point ended up in the same cell, and Erica nearly killed her cousin for snitching on them. Uncle Warren was sentenced to 40 years in prison for his part in the crimes and the murder of Andrea Krueger. His notorious uncle had just gotten out of prison for kidnapping and assault and was on his way back to the big house. He even still had burns from setting her car on fire earlier that week. Dry Olivetti evaluated all the family members involved in these crimes. Erica was deemed so dangerous that he believed that she would rip the face off any prisoner they put her in a cell with. Even the guards were afraid of her due to her unpredictable behavior. Dry Olivetti believed that she would kill or assault anyone at the drop of a hat for no reason at all. In April 2020, the appeals court refused to hear Nico's appeal, and he is currently still in solitary confinement awaiting the death penalty. And now for another gruesome twosome. Part 3. Antonio Barbeau and Nathan Pape. Location: Sheboygan Falls, Wisconsin. In this town of 8,000 mortals, there is, on average, two or less homicides per year, as of 2012. When murder did come to town, the nature of it shocked the locals due to its cold-blooded savagery. June 17, 2013, 14-year-old Nathan Pape returned home at the end of the school day and went straight to his room. Before long, his friend, Antonio Barbeau, also 14 years old, joined him there. After conferring for about 20 minutes, Nathan asked his mother if she would give the boys a lift. Their plan was to pay a visit to Antonio's great-grandmother. The matriarch in question was 78-year-old Barbara Olson, who lived in a district of Sheboygan Falls called West Wind Bluffs. Mrs. Pape dropped the boys off at that address. If only Mrs. Pape had been aware that Antonio had a hatchet tucked in behind the waistband of his jeans. Outdone but not unarmed, Nathan concealed a hammer within his clothes. Their objective was to rob and kill Mrs. Olson. They plotted out the crime in Nathan's bedroom. They would enter Mrs. Olson's home via the garage, sneak up on her, and club her on the head from behind. She wouldn't even know what hit her or if she had been hit at all. They simply intended to turn out her lights with a single blow. It didn't go as planned. Barbara heard noises in her garage and went down to have a look. She was overjoyed to see it was Antonio. She was always happy to see her grandson. She was more than pleased to welcome his friend. Barbara stepped into the kitchen when the boys attacked her. She fell to the floor after Antonio struck her with the blunt end of his hatchet. She held up her arms, imploring him to show her mercy. Nathan joined him, bashing Barbara with his hammer. At one point, Antonio removed his sweatshirt because it compromised his agility. He couldn't beat his grandmother as effectively with the sweatshirt restricting his movements, you see. By now, Barbara suffered severe strikes to the head and face. Her arms and hands were deeply wounded. Eventually, she became overwhelmed by the relentless brutality of the attack, and she succumbed to her injuries. As she lay in a pool of blood spreading out across the kitchen floor from beneath her. Nathan and Antonio dragged Barbara's corpse into the garage. Their plan was to place her remains in the trunk of her car. The dead weight must have been too heavy for them to lift, for they left her on the cold concrete floor of the garage. From there, they took to the house in search of money and other valuables. The total combined proceeds from this crime were $155 in cash and a few articles of jewelry. The boys drove the car around town, eventually leaving it behind a bowling alley. The key was left in the ignition, and the jewelry was left on the front seats. They used the cash to go out for pizza and buy some pot. 2 days later, Barbara's daughter, Judy Offutt, discovered her body. At first, it occurred to her that her mother might have had a fall, but the blood trails and streaks left on the floor indicated that she had been dragged to where she was found. Judy called the police. Investigators soon found out that Antonio paid a visit to Barbara's home the afternoon she was killed. They do tend to look at family first. Antonio was interviewed as a witness, and his answers to the questions gave rise to so much suspicion they could smell it in the air, like a slaughterhouse dumpster during a heat wave. The detectives sought and obtained a warrant for his bedroom and his locker at school. They hit pay dirt. How many high school students keep blood-splattered clothes and shoes in their locker? I didn't. I'm not so sure about you. Bloody clothes and his great-grandmother's gold watch were discovered under his bed. Police found Barbara's purse in a storm drain close to her home. Within 12 hours of the discovery of Barbara Olson's body, Antonio Barbo and Nathan Pape were placed under arrest. The district attorney soon announced they would be tried as adults. January 2013, Antonio submitted a plea of not guilty by mental disease or defect. He buttressed this by reporting that he was hit by a car at the age of 10 and he acquired a brain injury as a consequence. His family asserted that he was mentally impaired since the accident. 2 weeks later, Anthony Pape entered a not guilty plea. He insisted that he didn't actually participate in the murder and that he only accompanied Antonio because he didn't want to disappoint him. His parents pointed out that he had the mental capacity of a 10-year-old and was easily influenced by others. An assembly of experts ruled that Antonio was not mentally impaired and was responsible for his actions. The only option left was for his lawyers to strike a plea deal, whereby he would serve 35 years and testify against Nathan. The deal was accepted. His family insisted Barbara would have wanted a more lenient sentence for Antonio. The judge wasn't swayed. At the trial of Nathan Pape, results from the autopsy were introduced. The coroner found that Barbara Olson was struck with both blunt and sharp objects. Nathan admitted to striking Olson, but emphasized that he was forced by Antonio to do so. The jury did not sympathize, especially after seeing the autopsy photos. Even hard-boiled detectives had to turn away. They were so disturbed by them. The autopsy revealed that Barbara knew what was happening to her while she was being assaulted and that she experienced extreme distress throughout the act. Nathan Pape was found guilty. He was sentenced to a life term of 31 years. Judge Timothy Van Akeren said, "This is the worst crime that I have encountered in my 24 years on the bench. I've not seen anything of this nature, not even close." This episode was written by Morgan Rector and Misdemeanor. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.